this is a deep problem. Because think about the harm and the suffering that comes from people's, how it becomes from their uncertainty to needing certainty to believe in something that is so fallacious.
Well, this has happened many times in human history. This is by no means anything new, right?
No, that's why we're having the discussion about certainty is because there's something very human about it. Welcome to the QR Lab. My name's Kuldeep Tagore, and I'm here today with, of course, the one and only...
Amr Zuki, how you doing, my friend?
...partner in crime.
Yes, sir.
Looking into the QR. Q. We're R. on a quest. We're on a quest. But also questioning as we go. And R for reality. This is a question as old as time. Correct? We're always on the lookout and the wonder of the world. So, we're here today to question our reality and to have a discussion. I think that, you know, the very title of our podcast kind of lends to this idea of that there's some uncertainty. Because if you are certain, you wouldn't ask questions, right? Questions are asked out of curiosity, but they're also asked out of a desire to know, to learn, to figure out, to understand.
So, yes. So I mean, we are talking today, about uncertainty, right? That's the topic of the day.
It just seems that we live in a world now where people are so sure of things, right? And maybe it's always been like that. Maybe people have to walk around feeling sure, feeling certain, feeling confident about their world. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't be able to even get up in the morning and get to work. You'd be too worried about these questions, right? So you have to have some level of certainty. You've got to know that when you get into your car and you put the key in the ignition that it will start. You have to have a certain degree of certainty.
Oh, the sun will rise in the morning.
You have to be certain about certain things.
Right. I mean, it's 100% that the sun rises, right? But there will come a day when the sun does not rise.
Will there? Are you so certain?
That's a good question. I mean, according to scientific predictions, but of course, there's always a level of margin of error, right, in everything.
Why do you think it is that people are so certain about things? They're so sure.
Well, there's a psychological element.
And specifically, I want to say people who we can say are actually objectively wrong. Let's attack that problem first.
Okay, that's a good one.
Right? Because to stay away from faith, I mean, there's another whole discussion there about people who have faith, right? Faith almost implies the ultimate level of certainty.
That's a very good question. So that's a very nuanced question. So you recall on prior discussions and podcasts, we talked about implicit knowledge, right? That people have a certain bias or understanding. Sometimes they're not even aware of what the hidden premises are, right? But they have a sense about something, right? Which gives them an inclination towards, you know, a belief system or an idea about that thing. And actually, I think in psychology, they've even studied sort of this inclination towards a more of a conservative state of mind or personality versus something a little bit more liberal and progressive that seems to have some kind of developmental or even, you know, perhaps genetic component. I'm not 100% sure about that. But certainly in the field of psychology, they've began to look at this. And that has something to do with sort of implicit knowledge or perhaps the way you're raised or perhaps, you know, what was, you know, epigenetically passed on. There's many, many elements to that level of complexity. But I think the question about certainty that you raised, you know, you mentioned religion as well, it really has to do with psychological elements, right? Because sometimes pretending to be certain is a reaction to deep uncertainty, is it not?
Correct.
So
it's almost a defense mechanism, right?
Correct, right. So what is certainty truly? Can you be certain about anything? I think under certain conditions and certain topics, I think the answer could be yes or close to yes. But for the majority of things, there's a level of uncertainty. For example, you go to sleep tonight. Are you going to wake up tomorrow? There is a probability that you won't. Right? You get in your car. You're driving to the local gas station. There's a certain probability you'll have an accident half a mile from your house. You get on an airplane. You're going to fly, you know, across the country to the East Coast. There is a tiny probability that airplane will crash. Or that pilot will have a heart attack. Or a satellite will fall from the sky and clip off one of your wings immediately, bringing the plane down, right? The number of things that could go wrong and the probability and the uncertainty associated with that is almost infinite. That's literally the universe and the world we live in. So the question you've posed is, in a sea of uncertainty, how is it that we have any certainty? Is that not the question?
That is the question. There really is no certainty. I mean, there's a book called The Three Body Problem. There's actually three books. It was a series. And in this, this is a fictional science fiction book where they create this world where there's three suns. These aliens live in a situation where it's called Trisolaris because there are these three suns. So this creates a incredible problem for this civilization. There's no certainty, right? But they do evolve to a point where they actually want to come and invade Earth. Okay, so that's the concept. But these people evolved in a environment. Like, we have a very high degree of certainty, like you sort of, in terms of our lifespans. We can pretty much, like you said, the sun is going to go out, but we know that's not going to happen for
billions of years.
Yes, but so we have this level of certainty that, hey, we're good. I'm good for the next 100 years to be here on this planet.
In your lifetime, maybe you're good. Yeah.
In my lifetime, correct. But that's all that really matters in my lifetime, right? Right? In terms of certainty. Yeah. I have a degree of certainty because science has helped us predict, and also just our daily observations, our daily lives, that things are going to be okay. The sun is going to keep coming up in the morning. It's going to set in the evening, right?
So what have you just said? You just identified certainty predicated on contingencies. They're all contingent on other things. Mm-hmm. In my lifetime, the sun will rise every day. The science tells you that it's 100%, right? As far as we know, right?
99.99999.
I mean, it's effectively 100, right?
Yeah, so, effectively 100.
So your certainty has contingencies. It's contingent and based on certain parameters and delimitations. That's the examples you're giving. That's what you're getting at.
So in this model where this civilization had to evolve under the most uncertain conditions. They were not sure what was going to happen because of the uncertainty of the three suns, right? Like that are surrounding their living environment. That there is no, but because of that, it forced them to become even more advanced to the point where they were able to develop interstellar travel, where we haven't even developed that yet, really, truly. Right?
Right.
So it's interesting how there's living in uncertainty can actually be a way to propel yourself, to advance yourself, to get even further because of this uncertainty. You have to take additional efforts and precautions to survive.
We've kind of done this with probability, the field of probability. It's a mathematical field, right? Or statistics. The mathematical application is sort of a technology, right? It's an intellectual technology to address the uncertainty in many things. I mean, we use this in medicine all the time, right? P-value less than 0.05.
Right.
We've arbitrarily chosen that to be something that we call statistically significant. But probability, and even in our clinical practice, where the uncertainty that we face, which is daily and constant, is mitigated by probabilistic thinking, right? Likelihood ratios, Bayesian probability. We apply these things partly intuitively and partly, you know, mathematically when we do our actual scientific studies. And we apply to the world of clinical care, okay, which has to do with behaviors, right? And application of various procedures or knowledge that are being used to help care and manage, you know, medical diseases. Those things help us make a judgment as to which therapies, which procedures, or even on a level of a single patient, when you're interacting, you're making a decision. Should I order this test or that test?
Right.
Is it going to change my quote-unquote post-test probability? Right? That's what that's all about. So the field of probability, you know, or statistics, what's dealing with probabilities really came into existence in order to address this problem. Just like you were saying in that book, you know, the uncertainty forced them to have technological advancements. So, yes, the incredible uncertainty creates a driver, right, or an impetus to have more certainty or to develop programs or models that will reduce the uncertainty.
I also want to just mention that I've been watching these political YouTube videos where they interview, a lot of them are actually interviewing the MAGA contingent, and they ask them questions. You'll see this on TYT, the Young Turks. But there are also these very young YouTubers who've made kind of careers out of this, because it's fascinating stuff to be able to interview people. This MAGA, like almost, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say like this MAGA cult that has developed in the United States. Make America Great Again, led by Donald Trump. This cult-like behavior that believes against objective facts. They cannot be convinced. And you can offer, but it is impossible to get these people to change their mind. Even by just having rational discussions, they will not believe you, because they believe that there is an underlying, they're so strongly believe that there's an underlying conspiracy going on. So it's kind of like the uncertainty of their government, or inability to truly trust the powers that be, the establishment, the government. That uncertainty has now turned into the need to believe in something certain. And along comes a very charismatic, powerful figure who gives them that certainty, who says, they are lying to you. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, I know, because I'm part of that club.
I've been to the swamp.
I know how these people think. And so this person, Donald Trump, now becomes the centerpiece, right, for something certain. They will only believe him.
Only like a symbol, like a political symbol.
I mean, this might actually upset people who are, you know, supporters, but we have to be able to have these discussions. And, you know, like we get ruthlessly attacked, but I think that's okay, because that only exemplifies the point that I'm making, is that they can only deal with this uncertainty. That when we present the idea that maybe Donald Trump is really the greatest con man who's ever lived, he's a grifter, he's somebody who has made his entire career on the grift, and they will say that, oh, that's just, those are just talking points from from his opponents. But there's actually objective evidence. Like, if you take this to court and we were to have debates, and I don't think we need to do that here, especially not without, a representative from the other side listing out all the data, they still won't believe it. It's like their brains will explode.
But why don't we talk about the deeper problem? This also reminds me.
This is a deep problem.
Right.
Because think about the harm and the suffering that comes from people's, how it becomes from their uncertainty to needing certainty to believe in something that is so fallacious.
Well, this has happened many times in human history. This is by no means anything new, right?
No, that's why we're having the discussion about certainty, is because there's something very human about it.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm getting at. Is there's also this idea of saviors, right? Even religion, right? You have these very exalted people who get revelations, and they tell people, like, this is what's happening in the nature of reality. All your uncertainty about your existence, this is what's going on. This is the explanation. You have philosophers. Science is trying to do it. Artists are trying to do it. So everyone is dealing with uncertainty in their own way. So from a political standpoint, you talk about the MAGA, political slogan. Of course, the liberals and the progressives, they have their own. But let me finish the thought. Okay. These are all attempts to reduce uncertainty and the fear that comes from uncertainty. Right? This is like a template, right? It's a general concept. And what you're seeing, that's a symptom of a general concept. And it happens maybe not in all political parties or all political spectrums, but I don't think anybody or any group is exempt from this. I think anybody could potentially fall in that trap if you come from a group that you feel in that group that you're disadvantaged or whatever. That may not be true, but let's just say that's your perception. So this is a general and protracted human historical problem. Exactly what you're describing. It's not new whatsoever. It keeps recurring and repeating in history.
Yeah, I think we need uncertainty, because then it needs to be debated. So, for example, laws. Laws are derived out of like absolute certainty that something is morally right or morally wrong, at least, or related to the society, that this should not happen and this needs to be punished, etc. You understand, right?
Yes.
Like, there has to be consequences to certain actions because we cannot live in a world where
It's chaos.
It's right? it just becomes chaotic. However, those laws need to be debated and reviewed and discussed and brought up for debate. So this idea that, yes, we have certain laws that are created out of certainty, but they're still open.
They're uncertain to a degree.
They are, but there has to be some level to it. So there's
exactly
there's this constant tension, I think, in human beings of wanting to have the answer. And when we have it, I think, for example, let's just take the concept of faith. For some people, when they find the faith, like a born-again Christian or somebody who converts to Islam, for example, they find a peace. They find a certainty with God that you can just trust and believe and it will be all taken care of for you. That degree of certainty, think about how important this is. What percent of the world are atheists? Like hardcore atheists don't believe in any of that.
It's just a small percentage, I think.
It actually is small,
very
right?
Small.
I mean, because if you really, it's not just a majority. It's not like 51% believe in God. It's something in the world. I mean,
atheism is probably less than 5%.
5 to 10%,
right.
We'll say, to be fair, including agnostics and people who are in the middle.
Agnostics
that
are different. They're a higher proportion.
Now, I'll say this. Of those, let's just say 90% of people believe in some form of a higher power.
Right.
How many of them really live their lives in a way where they truly believe?
Minority.
That's interesting. So you take the certainty of a God, and then you still go and do whatever you want in the world. Interesting.
This is the hypocrisy of the majority of humanity, unfortunately. And you know, we talked about this, how you know people will declare and say one thing and do another thing. You know, nobody's exempt from this kind of behavior. And you know, some people call it sinning. Some people call it, you know, laziness. You know, the fact that we're humans and we have to deal with all of the demands of life makes for an imperfect life.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is a human being, I think, feels empowered when he is aspirational because it gives you a target. It gives you something to shoot for. And, you know, one definition for sin is missing the mark. You're missing the mark. You're aspirational. You're shooting that arrow and you keep missing. You know, so.
Do you think that it's kind of like two sides of a coin? Or on the outside, we have to simplistically appear certain, right? You're not really going to want to have a conversation with me if I'm just, oh, I don't know. You're not even going to want to deal with somebody who's
pragmatic,
so unsure. Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Like
they
can't even decide where to park their car. Think about somebody who on the outside, if everything was they were uncertain about it, you could not live your life that way, right?
Right. You need
but
a level
needs
of
to
pragmatism.
Be on the inside, on the outside, there needs to be a certainty. I know that I'm going to find a parking
space.
You can't
function otherwise,
right? I know how to drive. I know how to take care of this patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know what medicines they need, and I'm certain of it. But on the inside, there needs to be some degree of uncertainty always, because I think that's what corrects itself. In case there's something new that comes up, something different, then you will be able to be ready for it instead of totally shocked.
Right.
You know, by the, you know.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a very kind of nuanced description of the response that you need to have in order to function pragmatically in the world. Because otherwise, you're not going to get in your car, you're not going to get in an airplane, right? All those things.
So, you know, I actually wanted to bring up that there is a article that actually talks about this. This is written by a Christine Carter, PhD, a senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Center. You can find this online. 7 ways to cope with uncertainty. Let's just take these one at a time.
Okay, let's hear it.
And number one, don't resist.
Mm.
Thoughts?
Don't resist. Yeah, that's actually, there's a lot of wisdom in that.
it's kind of like she says here, for example, you find in your marriage, you know, that's it's things are challenging. Instead of criticizing or blaming your spouse, two tactics of resistance, you could calmly accept your marriage for the time being. So the idea is don't resist. Things are uncertain. Accept that. Accept that, like welcome it.
There's a certain wisdom in that, although I would say that there are times things should be resisted and debated, but there's probably times where I think it needs a smart application of that.
It's not about the resistance?
Yeah, it's not 100%, right? It's a kind of like a like an equalizer, right?
Well, I think with uncertainty comes a concept of denial, right?
Yes.
So if it's so uncertain, you might just tend to say, oh, no, like the marriage example, right? If things are not going well, we just try to ignore it, try to keep pushing it down the road. It feels uncertain, but we're just going to, rather than just say, because that's denial. Mm-hmm. Rather than that's and denial is resistance.
Yes.
So instead of denial, accept it. Almost don't resist.
Well, that's a Buddhist principle, acceptance.
Yeah. So the second thing is to say, invest in yourself. I find that one kind of interesting. Mm. Invest in yourself. This is how you cope with uncertainty. What can you do? Right? I think powerlessness comes with uncertainty.
So they're talking about knowledge, actually.
Invest in yourself.
That's
take
knowledge.
Take that time.
Yeah.
Don't resist. Take that time. These are actually pretty good.
Actually, send me this article. I want to read it.
Yeah. Pretty good.
It's passed my little litmus test so far.
She says, self-care is not selfish. Right? Selfishness is an anxious focus on the self.
Interesting.
Being taking care of yourself.
I like that idea, yeah.
And number three is find healthy comfort items. This is a good one. What would be better when you're feeling... what comes with uncertainty?
Anxiety.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right, and fear.
So that needs to be mitigated in the nervous system.
Mm.
So maybe habits that are, you know, destructive are not good for you, but... going out and exercising. Go ahead.
So cutting out the heroin and the booze on the weekend.
Probably,
right?
Find healthy comfort items, not the put down the needle.
Drug addiction, right? That's a terrible one.
I love number four. Number four is great. Don't believe everything you think
or hear.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. You heard it. You saw it. But now it's here. And I think that's a good point. I think when things are stuck in your head, and especially when you're dealing with the anxiety of uncertainty, there may be a tendency to just start to believe that,
it's the parasitic voices that Don Miguel Ruiz talked about in the Four Agreements. Yeah,
that's right. That's like a negativity.
Yes.
That can overtake you.
These are all negativity checks, by the way.
Right.
Meaning like truly negative, like dark.
Right. So if you're... having these feelings of uncertainty, you turn them into something. You try to fuel, right? Like Trisolaris, like they did. They used it as a fuel to...
That's very interesting. The pop culture reference to that book is... I actually started reading it, by the way, as an aside, and I didn't finish it, but I'll have to get back to
it. It's a tricky read.
Please continue. I don't want to detract. Yeah.
Absolutely. So number five is pay attention.
I'm loving this article more and more,
pay attention. Right? Because you might devolve into your own head, into your own habits. But
so it's actually looking, it's the injunction here is awareness, self-awareness and situational awareness and paying attention, which when you pay attention, you're in a state of observation, you're going to get information, which kind of goes to self-knowledge, right? Or the knowledge component.
In the article, she says that even when it feels like everything is out of our control, we can still control what we pay attention to. So you still have that ability.
That's
so
brilliant. Yeah. It's very true.
Pay attention. So there's still a in the realm of feeling uncertain, powerless.
You have a choice.
Anxiety,
she's telling you have a choice, right?
You actually do, right? Mm. You can still control what you pay attention to. Now, there might be certain, you know, psychological mind states where people are they lack the ability to do that. But number six is stop looking for someone to rescue you.
Brilliant. I like that one.
There's nobody coming. You are your own
self-dependence.
You're your own hero of this story and your hero journey. You're the only one. They also have a quote in here. Uncertainty is the only certainty there is. I've heard that before. This comes from a quote from John Allen Paulos, a mathematician.
That's absolutely true.
You'll like the last one here, number seven. Is find meaning in the chaos.
I love it.
Find meaning in the chaos. Yeah. As you're paying attention to it, as you're either diverting your gaze or placing your gaze on something, you also have the ability to say, well, this must be serving a greater purpose, either for myself, maybe it's a challenge. I think you can reference one of our earlier podcasts on that subject. You know,
yeah.
There's a gift in in adversity.
Right? Absolutely, yeah.
So finding the meaning in this uncertainty.
They are interrelated. A lot of these two concepts. Yeah,
yeah. I think everything on our podcast can be interrelated.
Well, when you really look at a single problem that at the outset seems like unique and different, when you actually look at it, you see how it's networked to many other concepts, and you see their interrelationship. You know, like. We had one about discipline. We had one, you know, about randomness. We had one about, you know, adversity. Those kind of relate to uncertainty.
Yeah, and I feel that all of these discussions we've had are ripe for bringing them back and rediscussing them and kind of...
Like doing a deeper dive.
Yeah, deeper dive or adding to it.
Getting a guest to come. We have a few guests that will be coming in the near future.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. This is actually a very interesting article. Maybe say it again, or put it in the description of the podcast in case people want to reference this one. You know, and they can look at that independently.
Yeah. Put the link in the description.
Yeah. It sounds good. That sounds very good. So, you've sort of outlined a very important concept with uncertainty, and what you said earlier is most people are certain about. Many things or everything, when in fact, on deeper examination, one realizes just how uncertain matters really are.
I just wish that there wasn't these. I wish there weren't camps, right? Where it's almost like, maybe I'm speaking specifically in the political realm, but I think you can see it throughout even academics.
Yes,
and science,
it's everywhere, yeah.
Where people are. It's almost that selection bias to prove their point, like the refusal to be uncertain. Say I come up with a great theory, right? The theory of relativity. And I have to present this and convince people. So there, it does require confidence and a degree.
And a belief in it.
And right. a belief. And I'm very sure of this. And I present it and I go out. Well, that doesn't leave any room, right, for discussion. Because somebody may bring up a question. I have to be willing to keep the space open. Say, I'm glad you asked that question. Well, you are so certain, you would welcome discussion.
Exactly.
Well, you would welcome questions. You would welcome somebody who brings data that contradicts you. But instead, what we find that people would choose to bury that or to insult it or to diminish other data because it doesn't jive with what they are trying to prove.
Yes and no, but science does encourage speculation, or not speculation, but skepticism. Speculation too, but, you know, science actually wants that debate because they're trying to find better ideas. They're trying to find better hypotheses. So
you say that, but right? Like we've seen people who spend 20 years on their...
Oh, there's definitely bias.
And then they have biases and they don't want...
Yeah.
I think, you know, you brought up the very interesting example in the... Tell us about David Bohm. And Oppenheimer, right? Where Oppenheimer didn't want, or he was actually a graduate student of, David Bohm was a graduate student of Oppenheimer, correct?
I believe, people will correct me on this, but he worked with Einstein, and he was a very brilliant, young physicist.
He definitely worked with Oppenheimer on the...
I think he knew him or something. I mean, they interacted with each other for sure, because Oppenheimer knew him. And, he wrote this great textbook on quantum mechanics that, you know, was sort of the standard in, you know, Copenhagen and everybody loved it. But then, you know, he tried to propose in a paper a solution for what's called the problem of the hidden variables, which is addressing many of the problems and the uncertainties that arise with the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory. And in that description, he comes up with... something that is called, it's actually called Bohmian mechanics, named after him. And it has to do with this idea of what's called the pilot wave theory, which we don't want to get into right now because neither of us are physicists. But suffice to say, the point of it was to kind of get rid of the probabilistic nature of the theory and, you know, to make it more deterministic and address the fact that Einstein didn't like the randomness aspect of it. Again, I'm speaking in generalities, and I'm sure there'll be physicists out there that may correct me.
I know
me
the nuances on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and right. Certainly if I'm wrong, but that's my general understanding. But that was an attempt to address a massive uncertainty and the issues that arose with the Copenhagen interpretation, mainly driven really by Einstein, because he did not like quantum entanglement. You know, he didn't like states of superposition. Mm-hmm. You know, all the things that come out from a theory that's essentially based on a probabilistic understanding, and their core assumption is that everything is random, and then from that you have these probabilities. You know, the wave function that collapses when you have an observer looking at a particle, at an electron that then becomes a particle, but in fact its other state is a wave. And so, the best description is this probabilistic description, right? Which is non-local. It's non-local. It's probabilistic. And it is the most predictive and most accurate theory in physics ever created, which was what's really interesting. And so this attempt to solve this problem and this uncertainty caused so much upheaval that it destroyed his career. And one of the people who did that was responsible for it, as far as I know, was Oppenheimer, because it was so challenging and difficult to get agreement on the Copenhagen interpretation. Not all until today there's debate, by the way, but in general, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, to finally get people to agree that this is how we're going to, as a community, run our experiments based on, according to, you know, this theory and test this theory, that he essentially destroyed his career. And he left, you know, Princeton, and he ended up living in Brazil and becoming a philosopher, really.
So it sounds like, yeah, he became
buddies with Krishnamurti, right?
Buddies with Krishnamurti, which we've read. I have that book and also seen some of the lectures there, but... What's interesting there is almost like the uncertainty had to be crushed.
In fact, it's called the uncertainty principle, right? Heisenberg's.
But and the point I'm trying to make is that the uncertainty had to be controlled in order to proceed.
Right.
Right. That question wasn't valid. It's just that we need to shelve this in order to move forward. There's like a pragmatic way of looking at this, that we sometimes need to crush the uncertainty in order to move forward. But at what cost? Eventually, you have to pay the bill and you have to answer the question, right? You can't just keep shelving questions under that are actually relevant and important.
Correct. But another thing happened that I don't want to neglect in support of what you said. Despite that and the sort of the ongoing questioning, there's a guy named John Bell, who's a physicist who came up with Bell's theorem. And basically, he showed that experimentally, which is what made it very powerful, that the predictions of quantum mechanics are not they're not compatible with local hidden variable theories. Essentially, sort of not refuting, but opposing the ideas that Bohm was trying to propose. Bohm was saying, here are the hidden variables. It explains it in another way, which is Bohmian mechanics. And then Bell basically said, no, this is the experimental data, and basically showed, and what the current view is that quantum mechanics is fundamentally non-local and has outcomes of certain measurements that are fundamentally truly random, rather than determined by some kind of underlying hidden variable, which is really what Einstein and Bohm tried to produce. So you have this kind of battle going on, and finally there is an experiment that actually shows, no, perhaps the Niels Bohr idea and the Copenhagen interpretation is in fact correct, because here's experimental data showing that in fact that is the case. And so, you know, Einstein basically died not liking it, as far as anybody knows.
Yeah.
And he tried to address it in a very famous paper, tried to address the issue of hidden variables, called the EPR paper, which is named after Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, came out in 1935. So here you have giants in physics.
And science.
Obviously. Literally having a battle over the uncertainty involved. And in fact, in the Copenhagen experiment, there's a lot of uncertainty. One of them is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, right? Which is you can't know the precise location and momentum of a particle with precision. So that uncertainty is now actually encoded in it's that's what the Copenhagen interpretation is. That's one of its four elements. It's encoded in how the whole thing works, which is the philosophical implications of it are the natural world, the real world, is way stranger than we think it is, if in fact the Copenhagen interpretation is true.
Except that there are things that we are very sure about, that we know. Like, as we said, the sun's going to rise tomorrow.
There's a tiny chance it won't, though.
Yeah.
Probabilistically speaking.
So when we get down into the atom and we look at the subatomic world, then things become very, very uncertain.
Let me put it to you this way. You get up right now, there's a tiny probability you could walk right through the wall. Why? Because the electrons, which repel each other, that's the reason, right? I can touch this table. It's all electromagnetic repulsion, right? But there's a tiny, tiny probability that the random arrangement, the probabilistic arrangement of all the electrons in your body and in the wall are such that they won't repel each other. Right. And you can just walk right through the wall.
Right.
But the probability of that happening is so insanely small that it practically never happens.
Right.
So that's what this thing is saying. It's like, and that's, by the way, okay, we're getting a little bit off the deep end here, but that's probably one of the explanations for the lack of causality. That's one of the philosophical explanations for why there is, in fact, no causation whatsoever in all of reality. There is no such thing as A causes B. It's all correlation, but it has the apparent of causation. And that's time for another podcast.
Definitely, we'll have to do that another day. But I like that we set up at least some of these ideas, because if you're out there and you're curious about your reality, that's the name of this podcast.
QR Lab, baby.
We're in the lab. We're trying to figure it out. And, you know, to some degree, doing what we're doing is difficult.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And yeah. Because you're asking questions where people feel so certain. They're like, why are you guys asking these questions? Like, what is the... And you know, a lot of times we've had discussions where you say something or you ask a question that I think is so already... It's been discussed.
Mundane,
it's
like
been,
how motion happens.
But you're, yeah, like we definitely have to have a discussion about motion. But yeah. People who are just out there every day that maybe don't think about this stuff, and if they hear, why are these guys asking about motion? This is, why are they even questioning motion? Like, why are you even asking about it?
I'll give another, maybe this is too premature, but just like there is no causality, there is no such thing as motion either.
Just the appearance of motion.
Correct. If that doesn't blow your brain, I don't know what does.
Well, see, this is the thing. You say something like that, but it doesn't register, right? Even, I mean, if we hadn't taken the time to have these series of discussions where I know what it is you're getting to, we've had these discussions. If you just take somebody off the street, for example, these questions become very... almost irrelevant for their practical life, right?
Correct.
Like, they just doesn't matter.
Which by the way, which is why Donald Hoffman says reality, the probability you're seeing reality is 0%.
It's 0%.
That's why, because it's not practical. If you want to understand reality, mm-hmm. it's nothing like you think. It's so strange. And that's why we have a claim here. There is no causation and there is no motion. And as Donald Hoffman says, the chance of you seeing reality... for what it is, 0%.
But even the Hoffman concept that the way we're perceiving reality right now, the chance of that being the actual primary reality is close to zero. It's all based on theory. It's all based on evolutionary game theory.
His mathematical experiments that are looking at consciousness, correct?
Right. State that the probability that you're experiencing the primary reality is close to zero. In fact, more likely what we see here in our reality is the way you would look at a desktop. This is not the way. This is just a desktop. This is just an interface mm-hmm. that has been created. I'm looking at my laptop right now. I'm seeing these icons. The icon represent. Now, is that actually the article? No, right? These are just pixelations, and we've had this discussion.
He calls it the toggling of voltages.
The toggling of voltages and et cetera. And your example about, like, if you grab an icon on your desktop and you move it from the right side of your screen to the left side.
Yeah.
Oh, it moved. No, it didn't. There's nothing there that moved. Just the appearance that you moved it.
And we will get in another podcast actually in the details on this. And I'll just add one other element to this, which is the works of the physicist, mathematician, and philosopher, and actually to some degree theologian, Wolfgang Smith, who recently died. He was age 93 or 94. He talks about the corporeal world and then what he calls vertical causation. Then there's what he calls horizontal causation, which actually in a way fits the occasionalist philosophy. And we will get into the paper by Dr. Harding.
Yes.
Karen Harding, right? Isn't her name is Karen?
So this podcast is on uncertainty or certainty is really just a teaser for what's to come.
That's right.
This is a preview. Because you dropped quite a few things here. We've already discussed Copenhagen, the four agreements on, we've discussed, not the four agreements, that to be confused with Miguel Don Ruiz, but the
You're ahead of yourself.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So we're discussing quantum physics, right? Because really, at a certain level, although I'm not a quantum physicist, there are concepts in quantum physics that I'm capable of understanding. We should all be able to be capable of understanding because that is how people are trying to explain our reality. You talked about locality. You talked about superposition. Superposition is this idea that a particle can exist in
multiple states or multiple positions at the same time.
Right. And so is this, and the question in quantum mechanics was, is this particle a particle or is it a wave or is it acting as both? How can it be both? Right. That was a very, very difficult concept. And then the other concept is that nothing really is in any position until you look at it. So if you want to study this part, and when we're talking about particles here, we're talking about electrons.
The observer effect, right.
Right. So this electron, if you set up the experiment so that the electron's a wave, it's a wave. If you set up the electron so that it's a particle, it's a particle. It just depends on the observer. That's very troubling. That's deeply troubling.
Well,
right?
Well, you're talking about and this is the crux of the argument. Again, not to get off topic, but the Copenhagen interpretation has four key principles. One, the wave-particle duality. Two, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Number three, the quantum superposition, which you just mentioned. And number four, the role of the observer or the measurement, activity where you're trying to determine, is the photon doing this? Is it here? Is it there? Et cetera. Again, those are the four things. So you can't help but think that the strangeness of it is that the quantum theory, which is fundamentally non-local and essentially based on randomness and probability, is the most predictive and powerful theory we have.
That's incredible.
Do you see how strange that is?
It's very, very strange because that is what has allowed us to develop supercomputers in our hand.
And in the article you sent me on quantum biology, that's a whole other podcast, by the way. You sent me an article a couple of days ago about consciousness and quantum biology. Mm-hmm. And Roger Penrose and this theory with microtubules, which was kind of, people tried to debunk it. Now it's starting to make a comeback because quantum biology is being advanced. So here's the bottom line. I know we always say this. Here's the bottom line, right? We are reaching a point, certainly in this podcast, where we are beginning to see how the concept of uncertainty is really, connected to many, many different topics and aspects, both some of which we've discussed before and some we haven't. And like you said, it's sort of a preview or a preamble of what's to come because we actually need to discuss those things, motion, space, time.
I think what's evolving out of this is that there is no certainty. Everything is uncertain. We just have the appearance of certainty.
Just like we have the appearance of causality
motion. Yes. And it's practical. We have to be certain about some things. Otherwise, we can't advance. We can't get anywhere. We can't do anything.
If there was no causality and there was no motion and there was no certainty, pragmatically you could not function.
You just can't function.
Therefore, we must have the
illusion. Can you imagine trying to make decisions on rounds?
Therefore, we must have the proximate appearance of causality, of motion, and of certainty, when in fact, our reality is much stranger than that. Because in fact, both philosophically and at least quantum mechanically, it tells us otherwise.
Boom.
Yes.
And that is time for us to wrap it up. And so, my name's Kuldeep Tagore. I'm certain that my name is Kuldeep Tagore, but it could be now. It could be something else. I don't know. And I'm here with...
Rzeki, my friend.
Thank you so much for joining us. I hope we've stimulated your mind. Like, subscribe, check it out. Keep asking questions.
And comment.
This is the QR Lab. Peace.
The Q R Laboratory. We want to emphasize that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely our own, and they do not reflect the official policies or positions of our employers and places of employment or any of their affiliates. Additionally, our discussions on this podcast should not be considered professional advice or endorsements of any particular organization's products or individuals. We're here to share our thoughts and stimulate conversation, but we encourage you to do your own research and form your own opinions.